Chapter 21. This is really happening. Laurent. Are you all stressed out or excited? Sandrine asked our small team at the Forbidden Stories office on the Monday morning after we had sent the letter to NSO. This was the group of young reporters who had been on the project with us from the beginning, sworn to absolute secrecy, working long hours on difficult tasks for 7 months without cease. I mean, how are you doing? In between, Audrey Tavares answered. There will be my name on the article on NSO. I really want it to come out, and I really want everyone to discover this story and all these outrageous abuses. But at the same time, there's fear. There are three of us who are going to have our own names on articles dealing with NSO, Phineas added. Is there something we can do in preparation? For your safety? I asked. Yes, Phineas said. In terms of security, and also legally. Argentina, I offered. Tomorrow night, Terminal F in Wasi. We've got your plane tickets. We have collected your passports. We're all going to Argentina. It's just 6 months of our lives, right? We're going to leave for 6 months. The laughter was loud, almost fierce, which I was happy to hear. Because I knew it was going to take plenty of good cheer and camaraderie to get through the next few weeks. The publication date was less than a week away, and I could sense ill winds gaining force around us. Sandrine and I spent some of this short meeting at Forbidden Stories reiterating the same admonitions we had been making since the first hours of the investigation. Talk to no one outside the project. Do not say anything, even to one of our reporting partners, that might suggest a path to the source of the leaked data. And make sure if your mobile phone is compromised that there was nothing on the device pointing to the Pegasus project. Sandrine and I had started having Claudio and Danica do regular checks on our phones for signs of Pegasus infection, including three in the final week alone. The anxiety in our office was real, and it was not an entirely bad thing because we all needed to be on our toes, no matter how tired we got. Some of the most admired newsrooms in the world had been impressed with their work, and there would be time, Sandrine promised the crew that morning, to savor this moment. There aren't so many in a journalist's life, so take advantage of it. But not yet, I added. This is really the moment when we can expect a hard bit of, not a fight, but of intense confrontation. Sandrine and I didn't expect to have an answer to our letter to NSO for another couple of days, but we had a pretty good idea of what was heading our way. The night before we emailed our request for response to Herzliya, we had received a very odd call from an acquaintance who was in touch with Shalev Julio. The caller thought we should know that Shalev had said he was on to True Stories, as he kept calling us, and knew all about the list. Shalev wanted to warn us that the list had nothing to do with Pegasus, and if we published, it would do great damage to our professional reputation. Shalev Julio was mad at what he calls the True Stories, which he believes is preparing an imminent attack on NSO, I explained to the Forbidden Stories team at our Monday morning meeting. In the words of Shalev, according to the caller, they are totally wrong, True Stories. In fact, what they have is not what they think they have. He told us to be very careful because there is a real gap between what you think you have and what you really have. Be very careful. There wasn't anything to do, however, until we got a real and official response from NSO. What we could do while we waited was go about our business. Some of the partners were beginning to upload early, unedited drafts of their stories into the Pegasus Project Central database shared by all, which gave each of the partners the option of publishing stories authored by other reporters in the consortium. A few of the early drafts had unanticipated surprises. We knew Zybulch Boni had done really good reporting in Hungary for Direct 36, but his main story for the Pegasus Project was much more than we expected, in part because of his own personal experience of having been a victim of cyber surveillance. He described being outraged, ashamed, and somewhat proud. While the Orban government simply ignores my official media requests most of the time, it turns out they do appreciate my reporting after all, although their way of showing interest is maybe a little bit creepy. He also touched on his feelings about being the victim of spyware created by an Israeli company and licensed with the approval of the Israeli Ministry of Defense. Like many Hungarians of Jewish origin, I never attached much meaning to the state of Israel, he wrote. It's just another foreign country I've never seen. My only real tie to Israel is a brother of my grandmother, who went there after surviving Auschwitz and became a soldier. I know it is silly and makes no difference at all, but I would probably feel slightly different if my surveillance had been assisted by any other state, like Russia or China. Direct 36's reporting out of Hungary was enormously bolstered by Bastian Obermeier and Frederick Obermeier, as well as other journalists from Germany, the UK, and France, all of whom had done serious work in and around Budapest. A reporter from Le Monde had elicited an interesting response just a few days earlier from the Hungarian Ministry of Justice when he asked her about the apparent authorization of surveillance on journalists or politicians critical of Orbán. "What a question," she shot back, in spirited non-denial. "That in itself is a provocation." Statistics on the number of people in our data who had been selected for targeting, attacked with Pegasus, or actually infected, were still being updated in the final days. Of the 50,000 phone numbers in the data, we had been able to verify, with multiple sources for each, the identities of more than 1,000 people from 50 countries. The count included more than 600 politicians and government officials, including 3 presidents, 10 prime ministers, and 1 king. There were 65 businessmen, 85 human rights activists or attorneys, and 2 Emirati princesses. Craig Timberg's last-minute edition of an American reporter working in Saudi Arabia pushed our count of journalists to 192. As of Monday, July 12, Claudio and Danica had done forensics on 65 mobile phones that appeared in the leaked list. 35 showed evidence that they were attacked and or infected by Pegasus. Almost all the others were either Android phones or new iPhones that were not being used at the time of targeting, so cannot offer conclusive findings. The forensic success rate with iPhones being used at the time of selection was still above 80%. At that point, in the last week of the investigation, we had evidence of successful Pegasus infections on the phones of journalists, human rights activists, and human rights lawyers. We did not have evidence that proved an attack or infection on any politicians in the data, because we had deemed it too risky to alert these people early in the project by reaching out to request their phones for analysis. But we had not given up hope on that front, and we had a small window of time to make it happen. The team at Le Monde was trying to confirm traces of Pegasus on the mobile phone of the French politician François de Rugy. Siddharth Varadarajan, the editor of The Wire, was on a mission to add an Indian politician to the list of confirmed targets. Siddharth had tried with the chief political foe of Prime Minister Narendra Modi, Rahul Gandhi, but Gandhi no longer had the iPhone he was using near the time of his selection. Siddharth made one last try on July 12, this time with Prashant Kishore, who happened to be in Delhi that day to meet with Rahul Gandhi. This meeting between Kishore and Gandhi could not have been happy news to Kishore's former client, Narendra Modi. Kishore was among the most ambitious and media-savvy political operatives in India, and he first made a name for himself boosting Modi's rise to power. For the last 7 years, though, Kishore had used his considerable talents to put the brakes on Modi and his increasingly authoritarian brand of governance. Word in political circles in India was that Kishore would be working hard to unseat Modi and his adherents in the next big election cycle. Modi's team was paying attention. Siddharth had no trouble convincing Kishore to submit his phone to forensic analysis, which promised a poetic closing of a circle for our investigation. Sandrine and Sandhya Ravishankar had talked Siddharth into allowing the security lab to do the forensics on his own phone 4 months earlier, and his device had delivered to the project the first solid forensic evidence of Pegasus infection in the data. Now, here was Siddharth talking Prashant Kishore into one last chance for our consortium to get crucial forensic evidence before publication. It worked. On July 14, the day after Danica confirmed traces of Pegasus on Rugi's phone, he found evidence of Pegasus infection on Kishore's phone. So, now we had 2 politicians confirmed, both from democracies. 1 from the world's largest democracy. The security lab was still capable of conducting business at their office in Berlin, even after the terrifying server crash. Turns out, after some intense worry and some deep diagnostics, the problem was simply a strangely timed hardware failure. the equivalent of a carburetor needing replacing, as opposed to somebody pouring sugar into your gas tank. Our two technical experts were working down to the wire just like the rest of us, still with big things to finish. They were, for one, preparing to release a version of the forensic tool they had used in the Pegasus project. This felt to me like harnessing the power of Luke Skywalker's Star Wars lightsaber and gifting it to the masses. A most democratic weapon to do battle with a most undemocratic foe. The Mobile Verification Toolkit, MVT, would allow anybody, anywhere, to do a quick diagnostic check on their mobile phone and identify traces of a Pegasus infection. The MBT was not foolproof, and it would have a limited shelf life, Claudio admitted, but it was the best thing available and downloadable for free. Claudio and Danica hoped it would level the playing field just a bit, and maybe afford a little peace of mind to a whole lot of people. The security lab crew was also making the final editorial changes to their forensic methodology report, which had a lot of moving parts. The list of countries hosting the most servers where Pegasus attack vectors originated had to be updated with raw numbers. The UK, Switzerland, France, and the US were high on that list, but Germany stood atop it. Some of the biggest hosting companies are in Germany, as well as some of the cheaper ones, Claudio says. Pretty common destination when you want to set up infrastructure on a large scale. Claudio and Danica were also able to report that NSO had recently, and ill-advisedly, started using Amazon Web Services as a host for at least 73 of their servers. A forensic find on Prashant Kishore's cell phone just 4 days before publication provided Claudio and Danica new and disturbing detail. Pegasus had exfiltrated nearly 100 megabytes of data from the iPhone in the previous week alone, right around the time Kishore was meeting with the Indian Prime Minister's chief political opponent. There was evidence of an infection on that very day, July 14, 2021, which meant NSO's software could still sneak past Apple's current system of safeguards on an iPhone with the most up-to-date protections. Most recently, Claudio and Danica added to the introduction of their report, a successful zero-click attack has been observed exploiting multiple 0 days to attack a fully patched iPhone 12 running iOS 14.6 in July 2021. I checked my email inbox again and again as the appointed hour neared. The results were always the same. Nothing there. Or at least nothing I was looking for. Sandrine and I had asked NSO to respond to our letter by 6 p.m., French time, on Wednesday, July 14. At 5 minutes past six, I checked my inbox again and still no response. So I picked up the phone and called the company's press liaison. "How are you?" I said when she picked up her phone. "Very good," she responded, sounding surprisingly nonchalant. "Thank you for taking the time to take the call," I said. "I was just wondering if you are planning to answer." "Yes," she answered, still curt. "You can see it in your email now." I checked my inbox again. Still nothing new. "You just sent it?" I asked, continuing to refresh my email. "I don't see anything. Can you just check? You sent it like a few minutes ago?" And then suddenly there it was. "Okay, I see it. Thank you, bye," was all she said, and she was off the phone. I read the response aloud to Sandrine, trying to make sense of it as I went. "NSO Group firmly denies false claims made in your report, which many of them are uncorroborated theories that raise serious doubts about the reliability of your sources, as well as the basis of your story. Your sources have supplied you with information that has no factual basis, as evidenced by the lack of supporting documentation for many of the claims." The entire missive was barely more than a page, a typical NSO rejoinder, a standard answer to a very non-standard letter. Except not even really up to standard. There were a handful of typos and grammatical errors, as if Shalev had tossed it off in about 20 minutes while dealing with other business. The company had not denied, refuted, added context, or attempted to explain a single of the dozens of specifics in the letter. When making such incendiary claims, readers would naturally expect you to provide some modicum of proof, I continued reading to Sandrine. Instead, it appears you are simply furthering the salacious narrative about NSO Group that has been strategically concocted by several closely aligned special interest groups. the unsigned email from NSO.com simply repeated the Khashoggi denial, the assertions that Pegasus was only sold to vetted foreign governments, that no customer has ever been granted technology that would enable them to access phones with U.S. numbers, that NSO can and does terminate the system if the company discovers misuse. Simply put, the letter concluded, the NSO group is on a life-saving mission, and the company will faithfully execute this mission undeterred, despite any and all continued attempts to discredit it on false grounds. Sandrine was as nonplussed as I was. They seemed to let stand almost every fact in our letter. That's great for us, she said. It's really good, I agreed, as Sandrine walked me through how to forward it to our partners. The long wait was over. That's it, Sandrine mused. They have no answers, I said. In fact, they're just trying to catch points that are fragile, but they're not addressing the strengths or the gist of our questions. It's incredible. It's crazy. We went out for a drink to celebrate, and I wasn't sure how to feel except oddly weightless. I found myself thinking about the movies I wanted to see, the books I wanted to catch up on, the chance to get back to normal life and see my family. To actually talk to my family and let them in on the big secret I'd been keeping from them. I took the train home that night, 40 minutes removed from the tumult of the office, and got the first good night's sleep I'd had in a very long time. There was a slew of new messages on my phone when I woke up Thursday morning. The first email I opened was from Drew Sullivan at OCCRP, who had attached a letter he wanted me to see. Our partners had gotten a very different message from NSO, or rather from the company's hired lawyer in Washington, D.C. Our firm is defamation counsel to NSO Group, was the opener. It is evident that Forbidden Stories has already formulated, and intends to publish on its own platform, a false, preconceived, and highly damaging narrative regarding NSO Group, and that it intends to do so regardless of the actual facts. We are putting OCCRP on formal notice that Forbidden Stories will publish defamatory falsehoods about NSO Group in its series of articles, and that, should OCCRP elect to publish or republish any portion of those articles, OCCRP runs a substantial risk of publishing defamatory falsehoods. The NSO's hired attorney offered a brief primer on journalistic ethics and pointed out 7 questions from our letter he deemed false and defamatory accusations. But he did not explain exactly how they were inaccurate, let alone defamatory. The new letter did speak to a few specifics. The defamation counsel asserted that the numbers in our data were not a list of numbers targeted by governments using Pegasus, but instead may be part of a larger list of numbers that might have been used by NSO Group customers for other purposes. He did not explain what these other purposes might have been. He denied Saudi Arabia had targeted the lawyer of Jamal Khashoggi's fiancé. He denied that NSO had lost control of Pegasus in Mexico, or that any non-governmental users had the opportunity to abuse the spyware in that country, or that NSO Group is a tool of Israeli diplomacy, or a backdoor for Israeli intelligence. His letter was a little hard to decipher. The denials appeared to be dancing around or fuzzing the actual facts presented in our questions to NSO, but his strategy was clear. Divide and conquer. Each of our Pegasus project partners had received its own version of the threatening letter. I took the first train back to Paris that morning, carrying enough clothes to stay in the office for several nights on end. The next 4 days were going to be a big fight with NSO and a series of smaller skirmishes with the lawyers working for our various partners. In among the idle threats from NSO were some useful hints about where we might have a weakness in our understanding of the Pegasus system and where we might refine and sharpen our language. Crisis points reveal good journalism I've discovered over and over in my 25-year career, and they make it better. There are no mistakes until a story goes live. Until then, a writer or an editor always has the chance to improve the story. The best journalists are willing to admit where they've gone wrong and to fix it before publication. There is no honor in covering up mistakes. So, we had 4 days to make sure we got everything right to the satisfaction of the entire consortium. We each had to make sure that nothing we published overstepped the boundaries of evidence we had gathered and that the language in every Pegasus Project story was clear and precise. The Guardian's Paul Lewis was one of the first calls we had that Thursday morning. "So obviously we've all read the letter," he said when we got on the phone. For Paul, as for the rest of us, the letter didn't answer many of our questions, but it did raise some. He wanted to know more about the mechanics of NSO's bar on infecting mobile phones with U.S. phone numbers, and he wanted more precise information about Khashoggi's fiancé's attorney. He really wanted to hear more from NSO about the other purposes a client might have for entering a phone number into the Pegasus system. More than anything, though, Paul wanted to move quickly to compose a new letter to send to NSO asking for clarifications. The deadline was approaching, and he wanted the clearest answers he could get. "I think it needs to get there in their morning and give them a deadline of 6 p.m. that night," he told us. Danica ended up being the forensics point person in the final days and hours before publication, trying to reassure editors and lawyers at media companies across four continents and many more time zones. He was living in the alien hotel room where Amnesty International had stashed him for safekeeping, going on his second week in a room that made him feel like he was living in 1985. It sported a plush carpet and pieces of furniture that seemed unrelated to their surroundings and to one another. Danica had to put each of his three iPhones on silent mode so he could get a little sleep every night. He'd conk out long after midnight, after a 16-hour workday, and wake up the next morning, somewhere around 8 o'clock, with 50 messages on each of his cell phones to answer. The stress was intense, Danica remembers, but he tried to talk to every reporter, every editor, and every media lawyer to reassure them of the strength of the forensics and how he and Claudio had connected the evidence in the mobile phones to NSO and Pegasus. For security reasons, Danica felt it best to do all these calls in the bathroom. "Whenever the light was on in the bathroom, there was a loud fan buzzing," he says. "So I had a choice of yelling over the noise or taking the calls in the dark." He endured those final days, Danica told us, long after the project was over. "Claudio and I had put so much hard work in this for so many years," he said. "I can't let this blow up. We can't let NSO win by pushing back with the threat of lawsuits." Friday, July 16, just 2 days to get to the finish line, and there were newsrooms all over the world pushing toward the publication of the Pegasus project. The rollout of stories would stretch across 5 days, but the real grind was now. Editors and reporters were buttoning up all the stories for the week, and lawyers were over their shoulders doing the vetting. "It's a bit tense here, if I'm honest," an editor in one of those far-flung newsrooms admitted. The editor was already suffering from overwork and missing his family, but he did not have time to stop worrying over headlines, graphics, front page layouts, video packages, digital promos, and the explainer capsules describing the project, the technology, the victims, and NSO and its clients. "We have to run the explainer capsules in every day's paper," he told the graphics editor. In the middle of it all, the editor summoned as many of his reporters as he could for an important call to give them a heads up on the schedule. "All going well, and if we're proceeding with this project," he explained. "Then on Sunday, you've got to be around for checks and tweaks and the like, and we'll have the final sign-off decision. But I think the crunch point really is going to be in the next 12 hours. There was one phrase that clearly caught the attention of everybody on the line. "If we're proceeding," somebody asked. "Yeah. Is that in doubt?" "Well, it's never confirmed," the editor said, "until it's confirmed." NSO lawyers and spokespeople played a good cop, bad cop game right up to the hour of publication, the net result being a corporate filibuster. They refused to address all but a few specific questions we had put to them in our letters, asking for comment and clarification, and they steered very wide of any discussion of the forensic evidence that the security lab had presented to them. They could not reveal the identities of their clients, they reminded the consortium. They reiterated their great umbrage at any misuse of Pegasus and insisted on their ability and their efforts to root out any such abuse if they received credible reports. Of the 28 specific victims we identified to them, they refuted only a few. "A technological impossibility," they said of one. As for the rest, they claimed we had not given them sufficient time to check. They tried to throw a lot of sand in our eyes about the data we had access to, but they had a hard time keeping their explanations consistent. The partners, meanwhile, bent to the work of including NSO's responses in the bodies of their stories, as well as providing links where readers could see the NSO letters in full. There were more than 80 journalists on call to answer editors' questions or tweak language right up to the last minute before publication. But only a few trail bosses were actually herding their stories through the editorial shoots, each with dozens of features and sidebars and graphics packages to finalize, and most of them were flagging.
My brain's going slightly dead, one editor admitted.
Another had to stop for a moment to answer a text from his parents, who seemed to have lost patience at having been put off for so long. Problem? His colleague asked.
I'm just saying I'm not going to be able to call her tonight because I'm at work and I'm very busy, he said. I haven't told her everything because I was afraid she would worry.
Are you talking about your mom?
My mom. The last time I went to see my parents, I said, I'm working on a big thing right now. A cyber surveillance story. She said to me,
but why do you always get into complicated things?
The work went on in that newsroom as the reporters and editors worked together to finalize language and make sure the relevant NSO responses made it into the first day package. Then a phone call.
Oh, hell, it's my mom.
Hello?
Hi.
Not now. Not unless it's extraordinarily urgent and someone's dead. Okay, can I call you back?
Thanks a lot.
Kisses. I took my afternoon off yesterday because, by the way, it was my wedding anniversary, one of the colleagues said, commiserating. So I was at a restaurant, and as a result, I missed the call from the Moroccan embassy. Our own reporters at Forbidden Stories were still reaching out for last-minute comment. We wanted to include the voices of as many people selected in the data as possible in our first-day stories. Audrey Cerveri managed to get one journalist on the phone on the last day of reporting and explained to her that her number had been in our data, making her a possible target of Pegasus spyware. She stayed on the line for 40 minutes with Audrey, describing herself as a paralyzed journalist, unable to do her job because she no longer felt safe in her home country. She believed her work had even put her family in danger. Audrey gently explained to the woman that we had no evidence that the cyber surveillance was ongoing, and also offered to help with forensics on the journalist's mobile phone to be sure she was now in the clear. In the end, however, the journalist told Audrey she was too frightened to be identified by name in our report. Of course we will not name you, Audrey told her. I, of course, respect your decision, and it is totally understandable. And I'm just so saddened that you cannot pursue your passion of being a journalist. Audrey, trust me. One day I will talk, she said. I will talk. Then she started to cry. But right now, I cannot. I have a lot inside my heart. But I don't know you, and I don't trust anyone. They silenced us. At a few minutes before 6 p.m., French time, on Sunday night, Paul Lewis was still working on last-minute changes. He had been at this for days, and he was now standing over the shoulder of the Guardian's chief lawyer, who was doing a final check. So what's next? She asked. Okay, he said, pointing to a small box that held a key explainer capsule. Here's a simple one, like 300 words. Totally fine, I'm sure. The investigation was into more than NSO, Paul's colleague pointed out while reading the lead of the explainer. Could we say NSO Group and its clients? Paul suggested. Yes, she agreed. And its clients. Stick in, and its clients. 3 minutes later, the Guardian's series into NSO, its clients, and a whole lot more went live. Oh, effing hell, Paul announced. That was ridiculous. Danica was in his rented Time Warp hotel room in Berlin that Sunday evening, July 18, 2021, which, he noted to himself, happened to be the 10-year anniversary of his prank on Rupert Murdoch. He was still fielding messages from journalists in the consortium that evening because there were still 4 more days of stories to come. I was answering all the questions on my 2 laptops, Danica told us later, and also constantly refreshing various web pages. Le Monde, The Guardian, The Wire, The Washington Post, Die Zeit, Süddeutsche Zeitung, Kanak, The Raj, Direct 36, Aristegui Noticias, Proceso, and the rest. 17 media outlets in 10 different countries, all right on schedule. The Pegasus Project was bannered across the front pages of them all. Danica experienced a brief moment of realization, almost 5 years in the making. This is really happening. And then? Okay. All right. Back to work. Damien Leloup and Martin Unthersinger at Le Monde had been through the same fresh hell as Danica and everybody else. They had the added difficulty of needing a reaction from the Élysée Palace to the revelations that President Macron and most of his cabinet had been selected for possible targeting by a foreign government that was supposed to be an ally. The two Le Monde reporters had been key members of the first circle that Sandrine and I had roped into the Pegasus Project, which meant they had been working on this story nearly as long as we had. A few minutes after the first stories went live at Le Monde, they had a Twitter alert. Snowden? Snowden, Damien said, reading the tweet from Edward Snowden. Stop what you're doing and read this. This leak is just going to be the story of the year. Nice. The team at The Guardian was already refreshing the websites of the partners at a few minutes after 6 p.m., French time, and Paul Lewis picked up the phone to call Craig Timberg at The Washington Post. These two contemporaries worked for a couple of the most respected English-language journalistic organizations in the world, and they were normally fierce competitors for stories on both sides of the Atlantic. Today was different. Hi, Craig, Paul said and rolled into some friendly ribbing. You guys haven't published yet? Ah, you have now. Okay. We just wondered. We thought you might have got cold feet. Craig suggested to Paul he should check out the Post's Pegasus Project video feed. Oh, I'm going to have to subscribe, Paul answered, pulling up the feed. No, I do subscribe. Oh, nice graphics. Very nice graphics. Craig seemed not to be sure if Paul was still joking. No, I really like it, Paul insisted. You've got the scrollies. We ran out of time for the scrollies. My scrolly people are going to be furious when they see this. Oh well, look. Congratulations for getting it over the line. I was able, in an instant, to access scores of stories spooling out across the globe, and there was a particular name I found myself looking for. It belonged to the person who had been an inspiration and a spur for the Pegasus Project. The first name I had identified in the data, back in that rented flat in Berlin at the very first meeting Sandrine and I had with Claudio and Danica. Khadija Ismailova. There was something very gratifying to know her story was spreading across continents, suddenly accessible to hundreds of millions of people. Khadija, meanwhile, was back in Baku that day. She might not be able to free herself from government surveillance or the attendant harassment and intimidation, but I hoped Khadija was at least a little better protected because of the consortium's reporting. She was, of course, already at work on her next investigation into the LA of government, waging her lonely battle for democracy in the home she refused to abandon. There was a quote from Khadija in one of the Pegasus Project's first day stories that caught my eye. It is important that people see examples of journalists who do not stop because they were threatened. It's like a war. You leave your trench, then the attacker comes in. You have to keep your position. Otherwise, it will be taken, and then you will have less space. Less space. The space will be shrinking, and then you will find it hard to breathe.